up. Not just to make her look like a bad person, but to shift suspicion away from me onto some unknown person. Some guy from her past that no one even knows about.
I sit down next to him on the bed. Our thighs almost touch. What are the police saying about it? He shrugs.
Nothing really. He asked me what I knew about it. Did I know she'd had a child before? Did I know what happened? Did I know who the father was? I said no, it was all bullshit. She'd never been pregnant.
His voice catches again. He stops, takes a sip of the tea.
I asked them where the story came from, how it made it into the newspapers. They said they couldn't tell me. It's from him, I assume. Abditch.
He gives a long, shuddering sigh.
I don't understand why. I don't understand why he would say things like that about her. I don't know what he's trying to do. He's obviously fucking disturbed.
I think of the man I met the other day. The calm demeanour, the soft voice, the warmth in the eyes. As far from disturbed as it's possible to get.
That smile, though.
It's outrageous that this has been printed. There should be rules.
Can't libel the dead, he says.
He falls silent for a moment, then says,
They've assured me that they won't release the information about this. About her pregnancy. Not yet. Perhaps not at all. But certainly not until they know for sure.
Until they know?
It's not Abditch's child, he says.
They've done DNA testing. He shakes his head.
No, I just know. I can't say how, but I know. The baby is... was... mine.
If he thought it was his baby, it gives him a motive, doesn't it? He wouldn't be the first man to get rid of an unwanted child by getting rid of its mother, although I don't say that out loud. And I don't say this either. It gives Scott a motive too. If he thought his wife was pregnant with another man's child, only he can't have done. His shock, his distress, it has to be real. No one is that good an actor. Scott doesn't appear to be listening any longer. His eyes, fixed on the back of the bedroom door, are glazed over, and he seems to be sinking into the bed as though into quicksand. You should stay here a while, I say to him. Try to sleep. He looks at me then, and he almost smiles.
You don't mind?
He asks.
It would be... I would be grateful. I find it hard to sleep at home. It's not just the people outside, the sense of people trying to get to me. It's not just that. It's her. She's everywhere. I can't stop seeing her. I go down the stairs and I don't look. I force myself not to look. But when I'm past the window, I have to go back and check that she's not out there. On the terrace.
I can feel the tears pricking my eyes as he tells me.
She liked to sit out there, you see. On this little terrace we've got. She liked to sit out there and watch the trains.
I know, I say, putting my hand on his arm. I used to see her there sometimes.
I keep hearing her voice,
he says.
I keep hearing her calling me. I lie in bed and I can hear her calling me from outside. I keep thinking she's out there.
He's trembling. Lie down, I say, taking the mug from his hand. Rest. When I'm sure that he's fallen asleep, I lie down at his back, my face inches from his shoulder blade. I close my eyes and listen to my heart beating. The throb of blood in my neck. I inhale the sad, stale scent of him. When I wake, hours later, he's gone. Thursday the 8th of August, 2013. Morning. I feel treacherous. He left me just hours ago, and here I am, on my way to see Kamal. To meet once again the man he believes killed his wife. His child. I feel sick. I wonder whether I should have told him my plan, explained that I'm doing all this for him. Only I'm not sure that I am doing it just for him. And I don't really have a plan. I will give something of myself. That's my plan for today. I will talk about something real. I will talk about wanting a child. I'll see whether that provokes something. An unnatural response, any kind of reaction. I'll see where that gets me. It gets me nowhere. He starts out by asking me how I'm feeling when I last had a drink. Sunday, I tell him.
Good. That's good.
He folds his hands in his lap.
You look well.
He smiles, and I don't see the killer. I'm wondering now what I saw the other day. Did I imagine it? You asked me last time about how the drinking started. He nods. I became depressed, I say. I was trying to get pregnant. I couldn't, and I became depressed. That's when it started. In no time at all, I found myself crying again. It's impossible to resist the kindness of strangers. Someone who looks at you, who doesn't know you, who tells you it's okay, whatever you did, whatever you've done. You suffered, you hurt, you deserve forgiveness. I confide in him, and I forget once again what I'm doing here. I don't watch his face for a reaction. I don't study his eyes for some sign of guilt or suspicion. I let him comfort me. He is kind, rational. He talks about coping strategies. He reminds me that youth is on my side. So maybe it doesn't get me nowhere, because I leave Kamal Abdic's office feeling lighter, more hopeful. He has helped me. I sit on the train and I try to conjure up the killer I saw, but I can't see him any longer. I am struggling to see him as a man capable of beating a woman, of crushing her skull. A terrible, shameful image comes to me. Kamal with his delicate hands, his reassuring manner, his sibilant speech, contrasted with Scott, huge and powerful, wild, desperate. I have to remind myself that this is Scott now, not as he was. I have to keep reminding myself of what he was before all this. And then I have to admit that I don't know what Scott was before all this. Friday the 9th of August, 2013. Evening. The train stops at the signal. I take a sip from the cold can of gin and tonic and look up at his house. Her terrace. I was doing so well, but I need this. Dutch courage. I'm on my way to see Scott, and I'll have to run all the risks of Blenheim Road before I do. Tom, Anna, police, press. The underpass, with its half-memories of terror and blood. But he asked me to come, and I couldn't refuse him. They found the little girl last night. What was left of her? Buried in the grounds of a farmhouse near the East Anglian coast, just where someone had told them to look. It was in the papers this morning. Police have opened an investigation into the death of a child after they found human remains buried in the garden of a house near Holcombe, North Norfolk. The discovery came after police were tipped off about a possible unlawful killing during the course of their investigation into the death of Megan Hipwell from Whitney, whose body was found in Corley Woods last week. I phoned Scott this morning when I saw the news. He didn't answer, so I left a message, telling him I was sorry. He called back this afternoon. "Are you all right?" I asked him.
"Not really."
His voice was thick with drink. "I'm so sorry. Do you need anything?"
"I need someone who isn't going to say, 'I told you so.'"
"I'm sorry?"
"My mother's been here all afternoon. She knew all along, apparently. Something not right about that girl, something off, no family, no friends, came from nowhere. Wonder why she never told me."
The sound of glass breaking, swearing. "Are you all right?" I said again.
"Can you come here?"
he asked. "To the house?"
"Yes."
The police, journalists, I'm not sure.
"Please. I just want some company. Someone who knew Megs, who liked her. Someone who doesn't believe all this."
He was drunk and I knew it, and I said yes anyway. Now, sitting on the train, I'm drinking too, and I'm thinking about what he said. Someone who knew Megs, who liked her. I didn't know her, and I'm not sure that I like her anymore. I finish my drink as quickly as I can and open another one. I get off at Whitney. I'm part of the Friday evening commuter throng. Just another wage slave among the hot, tired masses, looking forward to getting home and sitting outside with a cold beer, dinner with the kids, an early night. It might just be the gin, but it feels indescribably good to be swept along with the crowd. Everyone phone-checking, fishing in pockets for rail passes. I'm taken back, way back to the first summer we lived on Blenheim Road, when I used to rush home from work every night, desperate to get down the steps and out of the station, half running down the street. Tom would be working from home, and I'd barely be through the door before he was taking my clothes off. I find myself smiling about it even now. The anticipation of it. Heat rising to my cheeks as I skip down the road, biting my lip to stop myself from grinning, my breath quickening. Thinking of him and knowing he'd be counting the minutes until I got home too. My head is so full of those days that I forget to worry about Tom and Anna, the police and the photographers. And before I know it, I'm at Scott's door, ringing the doorbell, and the door is opening and I'm feeling excited, although I shouldn't be. But I don't feel guilty about it, because Megan isn't what I thought she was anyway. She wasn't that beautiful, carefree girl out on the terrace. She wasn't a loving wife. She wasn't even a good person. She was a liar. A cheat. She was a killer.
Megan. Thursday, 20th of June, 2013. Evening. I'm sitting on the sofa in his living room, glass of wine in my hand. The house is still a tip. I wonder, does he always live like this? Like a teenage boy? And I think about how he lost his family when he was a teenager, so maybe he does. I feel sad for him. He comes in from the kitchen and sits at my side, comfortably close. If I could, I would come here every day. Just for an hour or two, I'd just sit here and drink wine. Feel his hand brush against mine. But I can't. There's a point to this, and he wants me to get to it. Okay, Megan, he says. Do you feel ready now to finish what you were telling me before? I lean back a little against him, against his warm body. He lets me. I close my eyes, and it doesn't take me long to get back there, back to the bathroom. It's weird because I've spent so long trying not to think about it, about those days, those nights. But now I can close my eyes and it's almost instant, like falling asleep, right into the middle of a dream. It was dark and very cold. I wasn't in the bath any longer. I don't know exactly what happened. I remember waking up, I remember knowing that something was wrong, and then the next thing I know, Mac was home. He was calling for me. I could hear him downstairs shouting my name, but I couldn't move. I was sitting on the floor in the bathroom. She was in my arms. The rain was hammering down, the beams in the roof creaking. I was so cold. Mac came up the stairs, still calling out to me. He came to the doorway and turned on the light. I can feel it now, the light searing my retinas. Everything's dark and white. Horrifying. I remember screaming at him to turn the light off. I didn't want to see. I didn't want to look at her like that. I don't know. I don't know what happened. Then he was shouting at me. He was screaming in my face. I gave her to him. And ran. I ran out of the house into the rain. I ran to the beach. I don't remember what happened after that. It was a long time before he came for me. It was still raining. I was in the dunes, I think. I thought about going in the water, but I was too scared. He came for me. Eventually, he took me home. We buried her. In the morning, I wrapped her in a sheet and Mac dug the grave. We put her down at the edge of the property near the disused railway line. We put stones on top to mark it. We didn't talk about it. We didn't talk about anything. We didn't look at each other. That night, Mac went out. He said he had to meet someone. I thought maybe he was going to go to the police. I didn't know what to do. I just waited for him, for someone, to come. He didn't come back. He never came back. I'm sitting in Kamal's warm living room, his warm body at my side, and I'm shivering. I can still feel it, I tell him. At night. I can still feel it. It's the thing I dread, the thing that keeps me awake, the feeling of being alone in that house. I was so frightened, too frightened to go to sleep. I'd just walk around those dark rooms and I'd hear her crying. I'd smell her skin. I saw things. I'd wake in the night and be sure that there was someone else, something else, in the house with me. I thought I was going mad. I thought I was going to die. I thought that maybe I would just stay there and that one day someone would find me. At least that way I wouldn't have left her. I sniff, leaning forward to take a Kleenex from the box on the table. Kamal's hand runs down my spine to my lower back and rests there. But in the end, I didn't have the courage to stay. I think I waited about 10 days, and then there was nothing left to eat. Not a tin of beans, nothing. I packed up my things, and I left. Did you see Mac again? No. Never. The last time I saw him was that night. He didn't kiss me or even say goodbye properly. He just said he had to go out for a bit. I shrug. That was it. Did you try to contact him? I shook my head. No. I was too frightened at first. I didn't know what he would do if I did get in touch, and I didn't know where he was. He didn't even have a mobile phone. I lost touch with the people who knew him. His friends were all kind of nomadic, hippies, travellers. A few months ago, after we talked about him, I googled him, but I couldn't find him. It's odd. What is? In the early days, I used to see him all the time, like in the street, or I'd see a man in a bar and be so sure it was him that my heart would start racing. I used to hear his voice in crowds, but that stopped a long time ago. Now I think he might be dead.
Why do you think that?
I don't know, he feels dead to me. Kamal sits up straighter and gently moves his body away from mine. He turns so that he's facing me.
I think that's probably just your imagination, Megan. It's normal to think you see people who have been a big part of your life after you part company with them. In the early days, I used to catch glimpses of my brothers all the time. As for him feeling dead, that's probably just a consequence of him being gone from your life for so long. In some senses, he no longer feels real to you.
He's gone back into therapy mode now. We're not just two friends sitting on the sofa anymore. I want to reach out and pull him back to me, but I don't want to cross any lines. I think about last time, when I kissed him before I left. The look on his face, longing and frustration and anger.
I wonder if, now that we've spoken about this, now that you've told me your story, it might help for you to try to contact Mac, to give you closure, to seal that chapter in your past. I thought he might suggest this.
I can't, I say.
I can't. Just think about it for a moment.
I can't. What if he still hates me? What if it just brings it all back, or if he goes to the police? What if...
I can't say this out loud. Can't even whisper it.
What if he tells Scott what I really am? Kamal shakes his head.
Perhaps he doesn't hate you at all, Megan. Perhaps he never hated you. Perhaps he was afraid too. Perhaps he feels guilty. From what you have told me, he is not a man who behaved responsibly. He took in a very young, very vulnerable girl and left her alone when she needed support. Perhaps he knows that what happened is your shared responsibility. Perhaps that is what you ran away from. I don't know if he really believes that, or if he's just trying to make me feel better. I only know that it isn't true. I can't shift the blame onto him. This is one thing I have to take as my own. I don't want to push you into doing something you don't want to do, Kamal says. I just want you to consider the possibility that contacting Mac might help you. And it's not because I believe that you owe him anything, do you see? I believe that he owes you. I understand your guilt, I do, but he abandoned you. You were alone, afraid, panicking, grieving. He left you on your own in that house. It's no wonder you cannot sleep. Of course, the idea of sleeping frightens you. You fell asleep and something terrible happened to you. And the one person who should have helped you left you all alone. In the moments when Kamal is saying these things, it doesn't sound so bad. As the words slip seductively off his tongue, warm and honeyed, I can almost believe them. I can almost believe that there is a way to leave all this behind. Lay it to rest. Go home to Scott and live my life as normal people do, neither glancing over my shoulder nor desperately waiting for something better to come along. Is that what normal people do? Will you think about it? He asks, touching my hand as he does so. I give him a bright smile and say that I will. Maybe I even mean it. I don't know. He walks me to the door, his arm around my shoulders. I want to turn and kiss him again, but I don't. Instead, I ask, "Is this the last time I'm going to see you?" And he nods. "Couldn't we?"
"No, Megan, we can't. We have to do the right thing."
I smile up at him. "I'm not very good at that," I say. "Never have been."
"You can be. You will be. Go home now. Go home to your husband."
I stand on the pavement outside his house for a long time after he shuts the door. I feel lighter, I think, freer, but sadder too, and all of a sudden I just want to get home to Scott. I'm just turning to walk to the station when a man comes running along the pavement, earphones on, head down. He's heading straight for me, and as I step back, trying to get out of the way, I slip off the edge of the pavement and fall. The man doesn't apologize. He doesn't even look back at me, and I'm too shocked to cry out. I get to my feet and stand there, leaning against the car, trying to catch my breath. All the peace I felt in Kamal's house is suddenly shattered. It's not until I get home that I realize I cut my hand when I fell, and at some point I must have rubbed my hand across my mouth. My lips are smeared with blood.
Rachel. Saturday the 10th of August, 2013. Morning. I wake early. I can hear the recycling van trundling up the street and the soft patter of rain against the window. The blinds are half up. We forgot to close them last night. I smile to myself. I can feel him behind me, warm and sleepy, hard. I wriggle my hips, pressing against him a little closer. It won't take long for him to stir, to grab hold of me, roll me over. "Rachel," his voice says, "don't." I go cold. I'm not at home. This isn't home. This is all wrong. I roll over. Scott is sitting up now. He swings his legs over the side of the bed, his back to me. I squeeze my eyes tightly shut and try to remember, but it's all too hazy. When I open my eyes, I can think straight because this room is the one I've woken up in 1,000 times or more. This is where the bed is. This is the exact aspect. If I sit up now, I will be able to see the tops of the oak trees on the opposite side of the street. Over there, on the left, is the ensuite bathroom, and to the right are the built-in wardrobes. It's exactly the same as the room I shared with Tom.
Rachel, he says again, and I reach out to touch his back.
But he stands quickly and turns to face me. He looks hollowed out, like the first time I saw him, up close in the police station. As though someone has scraped away his insides, leaving a shell. This is like the room I shared with Tom, but it is the one he shared with Megan. This room, this bed.
I know, I say. I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. This was wrong.
Yes, it was,
he says, his eyes not meeting mine. He goes into the bathroom and shuts the door. I lie back and close my eyes and feel myself sink into dread, that awful gnawing in my gut.
What have I done?
I remember him talking a lot when I first arrived, a rush of words. He was angry, angry with his mother, who never liked Megan, angry with the newspapers for what they were writing about her, the implication that she got what was coming to her, angry with the police for botching the whole thing, for failing her, failing him. We sat in the kitchen drinking beers, and I listened to him talk. And when the beers were finished, we sat outside on the patio, and he stopped being angry then. We drank and watched the trains go by, and talked about nothing. Television and work and where he went to school, just like normal people. I forgot to feel what I was supposed to be feeling. We both did, because I can remember now. I can remember him smiling at me, touching my hair. It hits me like a wave. I can feel blood rushing to my face. I remember admitting it to myself, thinking the thought and not dismissing it, embracing it. I wanted it. I wanted to be with Jason. I wanted to feel what Jess felt when she sat out there with him, drinking wine in the evening. I forgot what I was supposed to be feeling. I ignored the fact that at the very best, Jess is nothing but a figment of my imagination, and at the worst, Jess is not nothing. She is Megan. She is dead, a body battered and left to rot. Worse than that, I didn't forget. I didn't care. I didn't care because I've started to believe what they're saying about her. Did I, for just the briefest of moments, think she got what was coming to her, too? Scott comes out of the bathroom. He's taken a shower, washed me off his skin. He looks better for it, but he won't look me in the eye when he asks if I'd like a coffee. This isn't what I wanted. None of this is right. I don't want to do this. I don't want to lose control again. I dress quickly and go into the bathroom and splash cold water on my face. My mascara's run, smudged at the corners of my eyes, and my lips are dark, bitten. My face and neck are red where his stubble has grazed my skin. I have a quick flashback to the night before. His hands on me, and my stomach flips. Feeling dizzy, I sit down on the edge of the bathtub. The bathroom is grubbier than the rest of the house. Grime around the sink, toothpaste smeared on the mirror. A mug with just one toothbrush in it. There's no perfume, no moisturizer, no makeup. I wonder if she took it when she left, or whether he's thrown it all away. Back in the bedroom, I look around for evidence of her. A robe on the back of the door, a hairbrush on the chest of drawers, a pot of lip balm, a pair of earrings. But there's nothing. I cross the bedroom to the wardrobe, and I'm about to open it, my hand resting on the handle, when I hear him call out,
"There's coffee here,"
and I jump. He hands me the mug without looking at my face, then turns away and stands with his back to me, his gaze fixed on the tracks or something beyond. I glance to my right and notice that the photographs are gone. All of them. There's a prickle at the back of my scalp, the hairs on my forearms raised. I sip my coffee and struggle to swallow. None of this is right. Maybe his mother did it, cleared everything out, took the pictures away. His mother didn't like Megan. He said that over and over. Still, who does what he did last night? Who fucks a strange woman in the marital bed when his wife has been dead less than a month? He turns then. He looks at me. And I feel as though he's read my mind because he's got a strange look on his face. Contempt or revulsion. And I'm repulsed by him, too. I put the mug down. I should go, I say, and he doesn't argue. The rain has stopped. It's bright outside, and I'm squinting into hazy morning sunshine. A man approaches me. He's right up in my face the moment I'm on the pavement. I put my hands up, turn sideways, and shoulder barge him out of the way. He's saying something, but I don't hear what. I keep my hands raised and my head down, so I'm barely 5 feet away from her when I see Anna, standing next to her car, hands on hips, watching me. When she catches my eye, she shakes her head, turns away and walks quickly towards her own front door, almost but not quite breaking into a run. I stand stock still for a second, watching her slight form in black leggings and a red t-shirt. I have the keenest sense of déjà vu. I've watched her run away like this before. It was just after I moved out. I'd come to see Tom, to pick up something I'd left behind. I don't even remember what it was. It wasn't important. I just wanted to go to the house, to see him. I think it was a Sunday, and I'd moved out on the Friday, so I'd been gone about 48 hours. I stood in the street and watched her carrying things from a car into the house. She was moving in, 2 days after I'd left, my bed not yet cold. Talk about unseemly haste. She caught sight of me, and I went towards her. I have no idea what I was going to say to her, nothing rational, I'm sure. I was crying, I remember that. And she, like now, ran away. I didn't know the worst of it then. She wasn't yet showing. Thankfully. I think it might have killed me. Standing on the platform waiting for the train, I feel dizzy. I sit down on the bench and tell myself it's just a hangover. Nothing to drink for 5 days and then a binge, that'll do it. But I know it's more than that. It's Anna. The sight of her and the feeling I got when I saw her walking away like that. Fear.
Anna. Saturday the 10th of August 2013. Morning. I drove to the gym in Northcote for my spin class this morning, then dropped into the Matches store on the way back and treated myself to a very cute Max Mara mini dress. Tom will forgive me once he sees me in it. I was having a perfectly lovely morning, but as I parked the car, there was some sort of commotion outside the Hipwells place. Photographers are there all the time now. And there she was. Again. I could hardly believe it. Rachel, barreling past a photographer, looking rough. I'm pretty sure she'd just left Scott's house. I didn't even get upset. I was just astounded. And when I brought it up with Tom, calmly, matter-of-factly, he was just as baffled as I was. "I'll get in touch with her," he said. "I'll find out what's going on." "You've tried that," I said as gently as I could. "It doesn't make any difference." I suggested that maybe it was time to take legal advice, to look into getting a restraining order or something. "She isn't actually harassing us, though, is she?" he said. "The phone calls have stopped. She hasn't approached us or come to the house." "Don't worry about it, darling. I'll sort it." He's right, of course, about the harassment thing. But I don't care. There's something up, and I'm not prepared to just ignore it. I'm tired of being told not to worry. I'm tired of being told that he'll sort things out, that he'll talk to her, that eventually she'll go away. I think the time has come to take matters into my own hands. The next time I see her, I'm calling that police officer. The woman, Detective Sergeant Riley. She seemed nice, sympathetic. I know Tom feels sorry for Rachel, but honestly, I think it's time I dealt with that bitch once and for all.
Rachel, Monday the 12th of August, 2013. Morning. We're in the car park at Wilton Lake. We used to come here sometimes to go swimming on really hot days. Today we're just sitting side by side in Tom's car, windows down, letting the warm breeze in. I want to lean my head back against the headrest and close my eyes and smell the pine and listen to the birds. I want to hold his hand and stay here all day. He called me last night and asked if we could meet. I asked if this was about the thing with Anna, seeing her on Blenheim Road. I said it had nothing to do with them. I hadn't been there to bother them. He believed me, or at least he said he did. But he still sounded wary, a little anxious. He said he needed to talk to me.
"Please, Rach," he said.
And that was it. The way he said it. Just like the old days. I thought my heart would burst.
"I'll come and pick you up, okay?"
I woke up before dawn and was in the kitchen making coffee at 5. I washed my hair and shaved my legs and put on makeup and changed 4 times. And I felt guilty. Stupid, I know, but I thought about Scott, about what we did and how it felt. And I wished I hadn't done it, because it felt like a betrayal. Of Tom. The man who left me for another woman 2 years ago. I can't help how I feel. Tom arrived just before 9. I went downstairs, and there he was, leaning on his car, wearing jeans and an old grey t-shirt. Old enough that I can remember exactly how the fabric felt against my cheek when I lay across his chest.
"I've got the morning off work," he said when he saw me. "I thought we could go for a drive."
We didn't say much on the drive to the lake. He asked me how I was and told me I looked well. He didn't mention Anna until we were sitting there in the car park, and I was thinking about holding his hand.
"Yeah, Anna said she saw you, and she thought you might have been coming from Scott Hipwell's house. Is that right?"
He's turned to face me, but he isn't actually looking at me. He seems almost embarrassed to be asking me the question. "You don't have to worry about it," I tell him. "I've been seeing Scott. I mean, not like that. Not seeing him. We've become friendly, that's all. It's difficult to explain. I've just been helping him out a bit. You know, obviously you know, that he's been going through a terrible time." Tom nods, but he still doesn't look at me. Instead, he chews on the nail of his left forefinger, a sure sign that he's worried.
"But Rach..."
I wish he'd stop calling me that, because it makes me feel light-headed. It makes me want to smile. It's been so long since I've heard him say my name like that, and it's making me hope. Maybe things aren't going so well with Anna. Maybe he remembers some of the good things about us. Maybe there's a part of him that misses me.
I'm really concerned about this."
He looks up at me at last. His big brown eyes lock on mine, and he moves his hand a little, as if he's going to take mine, but then he thinks better of it and stops.
"I know. Well, I don't really know much about it, but Scott, I know that he seems like a perfectly decent bloke, but you can't be sure, can you?"
"You think he did it?" He shakes his head, swallows hard.
No, I'm not saying that. I know, well, Anna says that they argued a lot, that Megan sometimes seemed a little afraid of him."
"Anna says?" My instinct is to dismiss anything that bitch says, but I can't get away from the feeling I had when I was at Scott's house on Saturday, that something was off, something was wrong. He nods.
"Megan did some babysitting for us when Evie was tiny. Jesus, I don't even like to think about that now, after what's been in the papers lately. But it goes to show, doesn't it, that you think you know someone and then..."
He sighs heavily.
"I don't want anything bad to happen. To you."
He smiles at me then, gives a little shrug.
"I still care about you, Rach," he says. And I have to look away because I don't want him to see the tears in my eyes.
He knows, of course, and he puts his hand on my shoulder and says,
"I'm so sorry."
We sit for a while in comfortable silence. I bite down hard on my lip to stop myself from crying. I don't want to make this any harder for him, I really don't.
I'm all right, Tom. I'm getting better. I am.
I'm really glad to hear that. You're not...
drinking? Less. It's getting better.
That's good. You look well. You look... pretty.
He smiles at me, and I can feel myself blush. He looks away quickly.
Are you all right, you know, financially?
I'm fine.
Really? Are you really, Rachel? Because I don't want you to...
I'm okay.
Will you take a little? Fuck, I don't want to sound like an idiot, but will you just take a little to tide you over?
Honestly, I'm okay. He leans across then, and I can hardly breathe. I want to touch him so badly. I want to smell his neck, bury my face in that broad, muscular gap between his shoulder blades. He opens the glove box.
Let me just write you a check, just in case, you know? You don't even have to cash it.
I start laughing. You still keep a checkbook in the glove box? He starts laughing too.
You never know,
he says. You never know when you're going to have to bail out your insane ex-wife. He rubs his thumb over my cheekbone. I raise my hand and take his in mine and kiss his palm.
Promise me,
he says gruffly.
You'll stay away from Scott Hipwell. Promise me, Rach.
I promise, I say, and I mean it, and I can hardly see for joy, because I realize that he's not just worried about me. He's jealous. Tuesday, the 13th of August, 2013. Early morning. I'm on the train, looking out at a pile of clothes on the side of the tracks. Dark blue cloth. A dress, I think, with a black belt. I can't imagine how it ended up down there. That certainly wasn't left behind by the engineers. We're moving, glacially though, so I have plenty of time to look. And it seems to me that I've seen that dress before. I've seen someone wearing it. I can't remember when. It's very cold. Too cold for a dress like that. I think it might snow soon. I'm looking forward to seeing Tom's house. My house. I know that he'll be there, sitting outside. I know he'll be alone, waiting for me. He'll stand up when we go past. He'll wave and smile. I know all this. First, though, we stop in front of number 15. Jason and Jess are there, drinking wine on the terrace, which is odd because it isn't yet 8:30 in the morning. Jess is wearing a dress with red flowers on it. She's wearing little silver earrings with birds on them. I can see them moving back and forth as she talks. Jason is standing behind her, his hands on her shoulders. I smile at them. I want to wave, but I don't want people to think I'm weird. I just watch. And I wish that I had a glass of wine too. We've been here for ages, and the train still isn't moving. I wish we'd get going, because if we don't, Tom won't be there, and I'll miss him. I can see Jess's face now, more clearly than usual. It's something to do with the light, which is very bright, shining directly on her like a spotlight. Jason is still behind her, but his hands aren't on her shoulders now. They're on her neck, and she looks uncomfortable, distressed. He's choking her. I can see her face turning red. She's crying. I get to my feet, I'm banging on the window, and I'm screaming at him to stop. But he can't hear me. Someone grabs my arm. The guy with the red hair. He tells me to sit down, says that we're not far from the next stop. It'll be too late by then, I tell him. And he says,
it's already too late, Rachel.
And when I look back at the terrace, Jess is on her feet, and Jason has a fistful of her blonde hair, and he's going to smash her skull against the wall. Morning. It's hours since I woke, but I'm still shaky, my legs trembling as I sit down in my seat. I woke from the dream with a sense of dread, a feeling that everything I thought I knew was wrong, that everything I'd seen, of Scott, of Megan, I'd made up in my head, that none of it was real. But if my mind is playing tricks, isn't it more likely to be the dream that's illusory?
Those things Tom said to me in the car, all mixed up with guilt over what happened with Scott the other night. The dream was just my brain picking all that apart. Still, that familiar sense of dread grows when the train stops at the signal, and I'm almost too afraid to look up. The window is shut. There's nothing there. It's quiet, peaceful, or it's abandoned. Megan's chair is still out on the terrace, empty. It's warm today, but I can't stop shivering. I have to keep in mind that the things Tom said about Scott and Megan came from Anna, and no one knows better than I do that she can't be trusted. Dr. Abditch's welcome this morning seems a little half-hearted to me. He's almost stooped over, as though he's in pain, and when he shakes my hand, his grip is weaker than before. I know that Scott said they wouldn't release any information about the pregnancy, but I wonder if they've told him. I wonder if he's thinking about Megan's child. I want to tell him about the dream, but I can't think of a way to describe it without showing my hand. So instead, I ask him about recovering memories, about hypnosis.
"Well," he says, spreading his fingers out in front of him on the desk. "There are therapists who believe that hypnosis can be used to recover repressed memories, but it's very controversial. I don't do it, nor do I recommend it to my patients. I'm not convinced that it helps, and in some instances, I think it can be harmful."
He gives me a half smile.
"I'm sorry. I know this isn't what you want to hear, but with the mind, I think there are no quick fixes."
"Do you know therapists who do this kind of thing?" I ask. He shakes his head.
"I'm sorry, but I couldn't recommend one. You have to bear in mind that subjects under hypnosis are very suggestible. The memories which are retrieved," he puts air quotes around the word, "cannot always be trusted. They are not real memories at all."
I can't risk it. I couldn't bear to have other images in my head, yet more memories that I can't trust. Memories that merge and morph and shift, fooling me into believing that what is not, telling me to look one way when really I should be looking another way.
"So what do you suggest then?" I ask him. "Is there anything I can do to try to recover what I've lost?"
He rubs his long fingers back and forth over his lips.
"It's possible, yes. Just talking about a particular memory can help you to clarify things. Going over the details in a setting in which you feel safe and relaxed.
Like here, for example." He smiles.
"Like here. If indeed you do feel safe and relaxed here."
His voice rises. He's asking a question that I don't answer. The smile fades.
"Focusing on senses other than sight often helps. Sounds, the feel of things. Smell is particularly important when it comes to recall. Music can be powerful too. If you are thinking of a particular circumstance, a particular day, you might consider retracing your steps, returning to the scene of the crime, as it were."
It's a common enough expression, but the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up, my scalp tingling.
"Do you want to talk about a particular incident, Rachel?"
"I do, of course, but I can't tell him that. So I tell him about that time with the golf club, when I attacked Tom after we'd had a fight. I remember waking that morning, filled with anxiety, instantly knowing that something terrible had happened. Tom wasn't in bed with me, and I felt relieved. I lay on my back playing it over. I remembered crying and crying and telling him that I loved him. He was angry, telling me to go to bed. He didn't want to listen to it any longer. I tried to think back to earlier in the evening, to where the argument started. We were having such a good time. I'd done grilled prawns with lots of chili and coriander, and we were drinking this delicious Chenin Blanc that he'd been given by a grateful client. We ate outside on the patio, listening to The Killers and Kings of Leon, albums we used to play when we first got together. I remember us laughing and kissing. I remember telling him a story about something. He didn't find it as funny as I did. I remember feeling upset. Then I remember us shouting at each other, tripping through the sliding doors as I went inside, being furious that he didn't rush to help me up. But here's the thing. When I got up that morning, I went downstairs.
He wouldn't talk to me, barely even looked at me. I had to beg him to tell me what it was that I'd done. I kept telling him how sorry I was. I was desperately panicky. I can't explain why. I know it makes no sense, but if you can't remember what you've done, your mind just fills in all the blanks and you think the worst possible things. Kamal nods.
I can imagine.
Go on. So eventually, just to get me to shut up, he told me. Oh, I'd taken offence at something, he'd said, and then I'd kept at it, needling and bitching, and I wouldn't let it go. And he tried to get me to stop. He tried to kiss and make up, but I wouldn't have it. And then he decided to just leave me, to go upstairs to bed. And that's when it happened. I chased him up the stairs with a golf club in my hand and tried to take his head off. I'd missed, fortunately. I just took a chunk out of the plaster in the hall. Kamal's expression doesn't change. He isn't shocked. He just nods.
So, you know what happened, but you can't quite feel it, is that right? You want to be able to remember it for yourself, to see it and experience it in your own memory so that, how did you put it, so that it belongs to you, and that way you'll feel fully responsible?
Well, I shrug. Yes, I mean, that's partly it. But there's something more, and it happened later, much later, weeks, maybe months afterwards. I kept thinking about that night. Every time I passed that hole in the wall, I thought about it. Tom said he was going to patch it up, but he didn't, and I didn't want to pester him about it. One day, I was standing there. It was evening, and I was coming out of the bedroom, and I just stopped, because I remembered. I was on the floor, my back to the wall, sobbing and sobbing. Tom standing over me, begging me to calm down. The golf club on the carpet next to my feet, and I felt it. I felt it. I was terrified. The memory doesn't fit with the reality, because I don't remember anger, raging fury. I remember fear. Evening. I've been thinking about what Kamal said, about returning to the scene of the crime. So instead of going home, I've come to Whitney. And instead of scurrying past the underpass, I walk slowly and deliberately right up to its mouth. I place my hands against the cold, rough brick at the entrance and close my eyes, running my fingers over it. Nothing comes. I open my eyes and look around. The road is very quiet. Just one woman walking in my direction, a few hundred yards off, no one else. No cars driving past, no children shouting. Only a very faint siren in the distance. The sun slides behind a cloud, and I feel cold, immobilized on the threshold of the tunnel, unable to go any further. I turn to leave. The woman I saw walking towards me a moment ago is just turning the corner. She's wearing a deep blue trench wrapped around her. She glances up at me as she passes, and it's then that it comes to me. A woman. Blue. The quality of the light. I remember. Anna. She was wearing a blue dress with a black belt and was walking away from me, walking fast, almost like she did the other day. Only this time, she did look back. She looked over her shoulder and then she stopped. A car pulled up next to her on the pavement. A red car. Tom's car. She leaned down to speak to him through the window, and then opened the door and got in, and the car drove away. I remember that. On that Saturday night, I stood here at the entrance to the underpass and watched Anna getting into Tom's car. Only I can't be remembering right, because that doesn't make sense. Tom came to look for me in the car. Anna wasn't in the car with him. She was at home. That's what the police told me. It doesn't make sense. And I could scream with the frustration of it. The not knowing. The uselessness of my own brain. I cross the street and walk along the left-hand side of Blenheim Road. I stand under the trees for a while, opposite number 23. They've repainted the front door. It was dark green when I lived there. It's black now. I don't remember noticing that before. I preferred the green. I wonder what else is different inside. The baby's room, obviously. But I wonder whether they still sleep in our bed. Whether she puts on her lipstick in front of the mirror that I hung. I wonder if they've repainted the kitchen, or filled in that hole in the plasterwork in the corridor upstairs. I want to cross over and thump the knocker against the black paint. I want to talk to Tom, to ask him about the night Megan went missing. I want to ask him about yesterday, when we were in the car and I kissed his hand. I want to ask him what he felt. Instead, I just stand there for a bit, looking up at my old bedroom window, until I feel tears sting the back of my eyes, and I know it's time to go.
Anna, Tuesday the 13th of August, 2013. Morning. I watched Tom getting ready for work this morning, putting on his shirt and tie. He seemed a little distracted, probably running through his schedule for the day, meetings, appointments, who, what, where. I felt jealous. For the first time ever, I actually envied him the luxury of getting dressed up and leaving the house and rushing around all day with purpose, all in the service of a paycheck. It's not the work I miss. I was an estate agent, not a neurosurgeon. It's not exactly a job you dream about as a child. But I did like being able to wander around the really expensive houses when the owners weren't there, running my fingers over the marble worktops, sneaking a peek in the walk-in wardrobes. I used to imagine what my life would be like if I lived like that, the kind of person I would be. I'm well aware there is no job more important than that of raising a child, but the problem is that it isn't valued, not in the sense that counts to me at the moment, which is financial. I want us to have more money so that we can leave this house, this road. It's as simple as that. Perhaps not quite as simple as that. After Tom left for work, I sat down at the kitchen table to do battle with Evie over breakfast. 2 months ago, I swear she would eat anything. Now, if it's not strawberry yogurt, she's not having it. I know this is normal. I keep telling myself this while I'm trying to get egg yolk out of my hair, while I'm crawling around on the floor picking up spoons and upturned bowls. I keep telling myself this is normal. Still, when we were finally done and she was playing happily by herself, I let myself cry for a minute. I allow myself these tears sparingly, only ever when Tom's not here, just for a few moments to let it all out. It was when I was washing my face afterwards, when I saw how tired I looked, how blotchy and bedraggled and bloody awful, that I felt it again. That need to put on a dress and high heels, to blow-dry my hair and do my makeup and walk down the street and have men turn and look at me. I miss work, but I also miss what work meant to me. In my last year of gainful employment when I met Tom, I miss being a mistress. I enjoyed it. I loved it, in fact. I never felt guilty. I pretended I did. I had to, with my married girlfriends, the ones who live in terror of the pert au pair, or the pretty, funny girl in the office who can talk about football and spends half her life in the gym. I had to tell them that of course I felt terrible about it. Of course I felt bad for his wife. I never meant for any of this to happen. We fell in love. What could we do? The truth is, I never felt bad for Rachel. Even before I found out about her drinking and how difficult she was, how she was making his life a misery. She just wasn't real to me. And anyway, I was enjoying myself too much. Being the other woman is a huge turn-on. There's no point denying it. You're the one he can't help but betray his wife for, even though he loves her. That's just how irresistible you are. I was selling a house. Number 34 Cranham Street. It was proving difficult to shift because the latest interested buyer hadn't been granted a mortgage. Something about the lender's survey. So we arranged to get an independent surveyor in, just to make sure everything was okay. The sellers had already moved on, the house was empty, so I had to be there to let him in. It was obvious from the moment I opened the door